First, I want to thank you all for being here. This is a very important part of our discussion. The President believes that clean technologies offer great high growth markets, making clean energy one of our greatest opportunities for job creations. So I also want to thank Carol Browner, and after my brief remarks, you will say. The Recovery Act has made a major down payment, $80 billion to both create jobs now and lay a foundation for a clean future. In the Department of Energy, we've had $32 billion in contract and grant authority. We have made selections for $29 billion of that 32, and this money is moving out the door. And so we've created thousands of jobs on a whole variety of issues, like cleaning up the Cold War legacy. For example, in Savannah River, in South Carolina, Maine announced we hired or retained more than 2,300 workers with the Recovery Act money. We're also creating jobs through competitive awards, the Clean Energy Department Deployment Projects, Smart Grid Projects, Advanced Vehicle and Battery Manufacturers, scientific research efforts. And one of our goals is to invigorate our high technology manufacturing sector. The Recovery Act provided a 30% tax credit to major clean energy manufacturing projects to ensure the U.S. manufactures the clean energy technologies we use. It also changed the way tax credits for renewable energy projects are given. In the past, you would receive these tax credits over an extended period of time. Now, as soon as you, for example, turn on the wind farm you've installed, you get the money up front. That, in many instances, the people have turned around and started a new wind project, and anecdotally, two companies alone have reinvested over $2 billion for them. The more clean energy products we deploy here, the more parts will be manufactured here, the more jobs will be created here. We've seen overwhelming interest in the Recovery Act funding. For example, our combined heat and power program was oversubscribed by about 40 applicants to one for every recipient award that applied. Our new technology program called RBE was oversubscribed by 100 to 1. 3,700 applications, only 37 were awarded. So clearly, we see pent-up demand for clean energy investments. And many of these projects have significant cost share requirements. And we've been, because of this, we've been drawing private capital off the sidelines to great projects. Many of the projects are exceeding the minimum cost share requirement. But the private sector, as the President said, is crucial for long-term sustainable growth. The government is there to get it going, but in the end, it's the private sector capital that's going to move America and create the jobs we need. And so what we want to explore today is what are the most cost-effective ways for government to spark private job creation now? What are the tools you might suggest, what steps should we be taking? So let me give you one idea, and then turn it over to Carol, and then we both would like to hear your ideas. In retrofitting homes for energy efficiency, there are roughly 130 million homes in the United States. Tens of millions of them can benefit from retrofits. And if done right, these improvements will pay for themselves very rapidly. So if you take out a low interest loan, a home energy mortgage loan, put it on PACE and property tax, if done right, those investments, your month-to-month payments will be less than the interest you're paying for, your decrease in your monthly energy bills. And so what are we doing to make this happen? First, there are barriers, there's inertia, there's inconvenience, there's a lack of information. And one of the things is, quite frankly, we believe that the costs can be driven down substantially. One innovative program we're starting is that we go on a block-by-block basis, get the neighborhood organization to try to enlist a sizable fraction of the people in that block to say, would you like an energy audit? Energy audit, a reliable company comes in and audit the homes just down the street. Then the insulation blowing machine comes in and goes down the street. And so it's essentially making retrofit mass production. We hope that can substantially decrease the cost, but also, if done well, it gives the homeowners confidence. Yes, I don't have to scurry around for five estimates and this and that. Am I really doing the right thing? So this is one of the things where we think it can take that sizable fraction of 130 million jobs and over a pretty short period, really scale it up to get those investments. So it's other innovative programs like that, like there are numerous that we have on the drawing boards that we're just trying to kick in. Again, we want to hear your ideas of other programs, but before that, Carol, it's yours.
First of all, let me join Secretary Chu in thanking all of you for being here with us today and for engaging in this very, very important conversation. Administrations have long talked about the need to create a different energy future. We are the administration that is actually doing that, and it is thanks in part to the leadership of our cabinet and Secretary Chu and others, but also to the hardworking leadership of all of you here today. Many of you helped us think about the Recovery Act proposals that we made. Many of you are taking advantage of them and implementing and helping create this new energy future. I just want to put a few statistics on the table of what's already happening, because I think it can give us a sense of what the opportunity is. In just 2 years, we will have funded more than 15 gigawatts of new wind, solar, and geothermal energy. That is enough renewable energy to power 4 to 5 million homes per year. We're doing that in just 2 years. I think our current renewables are at about 31 gigawatts, so this is a significant step forward. As you already heard from Secretary Chu, we're increasing our capacity to make wind turbines, solar panels, and other renewable energy components right here in America. The tax credit, the program that was created, is capped at $2.3 billion. Suffice it to say, there was a lot of interest in that program, and those announcements will be coming in January. Today, we have no electric vehicle plants in the United States. By 2015, we will have the first, the second, and the third electric vehicle plant in the United States, as well as 30 new battery and other electric vehicle manufacturing plants. What these plants will allow us to do is to produce 250,000 electric drive cars and the batteries to power another 500,000 plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. We're also building the charging stations. 10,000 charging stations in more than 12 American cities will be coming online. Many of you are aware of the work we've been doing to make the grid bigger, better, smarter. Just a couple facts there. By 2010, there will be 18 million smart meters, more than double the current number of smart meters currently in service. And by 2015, we expect a combination of public and private investments to produce 40 million smart meters. So we thought it'd be helpful to just sort of show the magnitude of what is actually starting to occur. Now, obviously, what we want to focus on today is how do we leverage that and get even more activity. And what we'd like to suggest, because there's so many issues and all of you have so much expertise, if we might maybe organize the conversation into three buckets. The first would be to focus on efficiency. The second to focus on renewables. We mean renewables very, very broadly, fuels, et cetera. And then the final to focus on clean energy technology, and manufacturing. And if that's okay for people, so that we can sort of maybe take 10 minutes on each of those and then have a more general conversation, I think that would be helpful. And are people okay with that configuration? So if we're going to, why don't we, if you don't mind, we're going to start with you on efficiencies. I know you have a lot of experience. You see consumers every day. You see people thinking about their homes and upgrading. And you can introduce yourself.
Sure.
We'll put you on the spot.
Okay. My name is Frank Blake from the Home Depot. So as Ms. Browner said, we see a lot of consumers and small pros. In fact, our business is about 30% small pros. People around five people. And that's the side of our business that's frankly been under the most pressure. And we do think there's some interesting opportunities in terms of encouraging folks for energy efficiency in their homes, whether it's through energy efficient windows or insulation or things as simple as programmable thermostats, replacing light bulbs with CFOs. There are a lot of opportunities there to make the home more energy efficient.
Is there anything you could see the government doing to help facilitate that and bring the customers into the store to take advantage of what you're selling?
So certainly the existing tax credit has been some help on energy efficient products. I'd say it might be worthwhile for the administration to look at that, maybe a bit too narrow, to how you could broaden that and have a broader category of products that would qualify, and also in some instances on the tax credit, your installation, your labor cost is not covered by the tax credit. And I'd say, as we're all thinking about jobs and building jobs, you ought to expand it to be able to cover installation costs as well.
Can I ask a question? In this program that I was describing, and I think the FOA is maybe out there or just about to be out there, do you see Home Depot as organizing across the country? You should take a small group of contractors, make sure that they do the energy audit correctly, so that you put your print on it and say, okay, let's go and do this mass production of, let's say, a third of the homes in the block.
Well, first off, I don't know how the energy, you'd need to describe it a bit more, how the energy audit would work. Who would do the audit? Does that constrain the availability of the program? Most consumers we've found, when you articulate for them, here's the benefit for insulation, here's the benefit of an upgraded window or a thermostat, et cetera, they understand that. So I'm not quite sure how the audit would play in.
Carol?
Andrew?
Go ahead.
Well,
we've done a lot of work in exactly the questions that you're sort of homing in on. There's no question that the consumer inertia and getting them to the other side of understanding that if you go and spend some money, you can save a lot of money. I think that's really the key. Can be enabled. I mean, I've got a picture of channels, and you know these back to front, Frank, you're here. But there's a lot of channels here, and the channel that has the path of greatest opportunities, the professional installer channel, the actual contractor themselves, who I believe with retraining that could be promoted by a systems integrator. Our company is in the channel a lot and could play a role as a systems integrator to help retrain, retool, and then educate the professional installers so that they can go out there and start doing these sorts of things. I think that could be an enabler, I think, to the integration that you're looking for. We've got a program with Duke Energy just on one of our products where they've made it part of the energy efficiency kit, and we have moisture barriers, air seal barriers, we have insulation. And when we deal with Duke, they gave it as part of a consumer kit to the homeowner as an educator, as a facilitator. The consumer has not reacted well to just the product side of it. It has to be the installed system side, which I therefore jump on this labor cost point. We'd have to overcome that particular aspect of it. So that's an enabler would be to get to the professional installer and help them.
I'm not sure if I'm going to be on the mark or not, because when Frank was talking about energy efficiency and private homes.
You should introduce yourself.
I'm Leo Gerard, I'm the president of the Steelworkers Union, I think. And my mind automatically jumped to something I've been running my mouth about now for 7 years, and that is energy efficiency and retrofitting more than private homes, and retrofitting buildings. And the place that the government could set the standard is in retrofitting all public buildings, and particularly federal buildings, whether they're courthouses or not. The place where I think you could have a huge impact is putting together a program with local communities and school boards of retrofitting public schools. We've got schools all over the country that were built in the 50s and 60s during the baby boom years, and they're energy inefficient. So if we're talking about energy efficiency, you can look at it that way. If we're going to talk later about retrofitting and stuff, we put it in that spot. But I want to usually be the skunk at the garden party, I'll do it again. One of the things we've got to make sure we're talking about is creating jobs in America. And if we're going to be buying light bulbs that are made in China, I'm not interested. As a jobs point of view, it might be good on the climate change issue, and maybe they're separated. But we need to have the kind of incentives that will have those light bulbs made in America, that will have air handling equipment for efficiency made in America, that will have glass. We have a wonderful building in Pittsburgh. It's diamond shaped. It has no inner walls. It's just glass diamond windows. But you know what? The building was built in 63. When I put my back there typing, I can feel the draft. We need to change those windows somehow. So those kind of retrofitting of buildings is huge. And if we have some domestic content, it's going to create jobs instantly. And not to be political about it, but if you're retrofitting the school that my daughter was going to, and she's going to have a better learning environment, I'm going to probably like you a lot more.
Thank you. My name is Phaedra L. Lampkins, and I run an organization called Green for All, and I want to thank you both for your leadership and inviting us here. We've been looking at some of these issues across the country and want to make some really specific recommendations about this area. The first is it takes 400 pages to do 400 pages of an application to do one solar panel installation in California, as an example. And so the idea of making it easier to actually do these things, we think would be really critical. We've looked at some programs, for example, in healthcare, where they've actually taken forms and moved them to one or two pages. So we talked to Kina Solar and a couple of companies who said, if you could decrease the amount of forms instead of even giving us money, we could increase our productivity tenfold. When we look at PACE, we think PACE is a good model, but also on bill
know what PACE is.
Oh, PACE, okay. PACE is a system essentially to pay back money that you borrow when you do some type of efficiency or retrofitting of your home. You pay it back through property tax. And it's the credit market likes it because it's a more reliable form that they know they'll get their money back. What we find is people who actually make the purchase or essentially borrow the money prefer on-bill financing. And it's much easier to get people to sign up for on-bill financing where you pay it back on your utility bill with the cost saving than it is for PACE. And so we have been doing on-bill financing in Portland, we'll do it in LA, or looking at it in a couple other cities. And so we've been doing a pilot project and testing it. And on-bill financing is much easier, though there's an encouragement in some of the
examples. So the utilities make the loan?
It depends. And so if you have a public utility, the public utility can make the loan, or a third party has an ability to make the loan. And Portland is a place that we just have done a pilot project with 500 homes. There's a couple other places, I know San Antonio and others, that are doing things, and so we'd be happy to provide the information. In addition, I think, to that, the thing that we're finding is I would just agree about the tax credit and the cost of installation. Right now, the federal government does about between $6,500 and $8,500. What we're finding is to actually install and do really quality efficiency, it's much more extensive than that. And so even in places like we're looking at Atlanta right now, it's going to cost probably about $12,000 to see enough cost savings to pay it back. And so we would just make some recommendations about the tax credit. And then on access to credit for small and minority-owned businesses, the challenge right now with both CIT on the verge of bankruptcy and other folks is just being able to get credit. And that what we're seeing is that contractors, you need a contractor big enough to do this work to create enough jobs. And when you're doing small chunks of work, it's not enough for people to want to bid on it. And so when you're looking at quality employment, it's hard to create quality employment with 5 to 10 homes. And so even if you can't, we haven't been able to get a decent sized contractor, even in this market, to do anything with less than 500 homes. And even at 500 homes, it is only the idea that then will then become a model for 10,000 that makes it worth it because of the investment and training, and unless you're doing very simple auditing. And as we think about the auditing, you know, I think there is some good models around volunteer auditing and around community organization. But what we found is the place that people are most likely to go is someone they recognize and know. And so finding sources to do that. And last, because I know this is a larger conversation than Green for All, is on the example where you actually have created incredible opportunities for school districts to actually do efficiency and retrofitting. And they then don't have to actually have an election for the top 100 school districts. The challenge that they're having is that it's scary to figure out whether you really do or don't have to. And the people that are most likely to see a cost savings are cold school districts, Chicago and others. And so figuring out how to make sure that people have information about what that really means and how it works has been really important. And so I think any ability for you all to do some basic official document or to actually be able to tell these school districts it's real, because the biggest challenge is going and saying to people, we did a presentation, and we know Sirius Windows, who's not here, Sirius Materials, has done windows, and they're looking in Chicago and other school districts, is that it seems crazy for the school district here, you don't have to have an election, and you can create efficiency, and it won't cost you money.
Can I ask a couple quick questions? There are a lot of good ideas. On the on-bill financing, what is the interest rate?
The interest rate is 2-3%. And
then something's sung subsidizing at 2-3%. Who it is?
2-3%. No, what we've actually been able to do is what we've done as an example is has gone to, is you go to folks because it's a steady source, so they will take 2 to 3%. And so everywhere from, there's a fund at Living Cities that will do it. There is also.
The consumer pays the interest as part of.
Yes.
No, but.
But what he's saying is the market, who actually loans it to you at 2 to 3%.
Yes. And so where's, but you know, that's below capital market. I mean,
we've been finding community finance development institutions, and so they're willing to make it. We also, there's a $20 million fund at Living Cities. It's really socially responsible investors that are willing to make that kind of investment. It's also a very safe investment. So we've met with some venture capital folks in Silicon Valley and have been able to think about the structure of the investment, because they can also pay it back much more rapidly, because you actually can make the loan to the city if there's a jurisdiction in the middle of it. And so it is a little bit more complex, but it is possible based on the time.
But if we wanted to scale this up, so mm-hmm. it really does 50 million homes over a period of a mm-hmm. decade, I mean, really significant. The 2 or 3%.
You'd have to increase the percent. Like, you couldn't do it. We've been looking at scaling it. You'd have to increase the rate that someone pays. And you'd also then have to think about increasing the amount of efficiency they can do, so they see that cost savings.
So one final question, sorry.
Mm-hmm. No.
That was actually our model for the retrofit program, to get a big, whether, you know, it would be a new line of business for Home Depot. Mm-hmm. Sears does siding. Mm-hmm. Can Sears do, reliable audit, go in there and do the really, you know, give you price points and, you know, payback, all these other things. What do you think the prospect would be to get big companies, whether it's a Home Depot, Lowe's, a Sears, and even your company? You know, yeah. And would you be game to say, can you, you know, get the trained auditors if you use our traffic, if you
use
our this,
could
if
do
you use our that?
See, that's essentially what we're doing do right now, mm-hmm. Very targeted way. So we could do it and bring a few others along as a systems integrator.
Okay. And then, yeah, and your systems integrator, but you provide the service, Dow is a respected company, they say, okay, great, I trust you.
Definitely.
They do, and what we found is actually there's also the best system is a lot of cities have people pay for sidewalks or trees or other things, and so there's actually a way to run it because there's some relationship, they have contractors that people have used, so if jurisdictions identify who the vendors are, and I think you all as a federal government could have some way of looking at who are the approved vendors or contractors, bundling them at a federal level, and so, but I think there is a way to do that. We'd be happy and have supplied some information, and would be happy to do that.
It's not the steelworkers' area of expertise, but I know that building trade unions have huge training centers. They've got 25% unemployment. I'm sure they can help.
No. The labor, and we're talking to community colleges, and how do you train that? But you still need a company to be the point company. This is, it's a one-stop shop. We will do this. And that's what we need.
Well, Mr. Secretary, that my company is that shop on the commercial and industrial side of the business. I strongly endorse what Leo has said. I'm sorry, EMCOR Group, Frank McKenna, CEO, the largest electrical and mechanical contractor in the world. And I endorse Leo's estimate of approximately 25% actual unemployment in our sector. I believe since the electrical draw from the commercial and industrial sector is more than twice that of residential homes and buildings, that the leverage and the immediacy of a tax credit program to incentivize the owners and operators of public buildings and private commercial and industrial buildings to retrofit for energy efficiency will accomplish a number of very significant short and long-term goals. We'll put a lot of people back to work right away. We're not talking about Tomorrowland in terms of green technology. The skills exist today, the machinery exists today, the implementation programs exist today. It can be done starting tomorrow morning if we get the tax credits right. So but long term, we're talking about significant increases in energy efficiency and energy independence for the country, and significant improvements in the competitiveness of American facilities.
I've been given a position I didn't want. Trust me, I didn't want this. But I just wanted to.
We're
raising
our hands to
you. We've now spent almost a third of the time we have, well, even more than that, on efficiency. Can we take a moment and go to the other two issues and then come back and have a bigger conversation? Can we go to renewables for a second and maybe General Clark, we can even start with you and the work that you're doing on fuels.
Well, thanks very much, Carol, and thank you and the Secretary for having us in here today. I want to talk on two renewables. First, I want to talk on on biofuels and particularly ethanol. It looks like the tests of E15 are moving in the right direction. And if that's so, that is probably the fastest way to create 130,000 permanent jobs and maybe a quarter of a million construction jobs virtually overnight. The market's poised. It's ready to go. There's a lot of people looking at these plants, cellulosics online. So I just want to underscore that's how important it is, as you know, we're putting about $300 billion a year out of this economy to import oil. So once we move to E15, hopefully we'll be able to then lay out a study program to get us beyond this and into flex fuel pumps so we can see the end of that $300 billion tax on the American people. Because I think the biofuels market can do it. By the way, we've also got some great stuff in biodiesel as soon as we get to the point of really encouraging people to use it. There's a lot being produced and trying to be shipped to Europe. I also want to talk about wind. The end of the investment tax credit cash grant is coming up faster than we think. The program started in the beginning of the year with a stimulus package, and it runs out at the end of December of 2010. And actually, the timeline for getting wind projects approved is longer than the time we've had with this cash grant. I know it costs money, but we've got a bad confluence of events in the wind sector. The financing model for passive tax credits tends to lead us to go to big investors, and they want big projects to justify the due diligence, and they want big construction firms, and they want big banks. So it turns out that for most of America, this is just a matter of sort of leasing your land and watching your money disappear. They're just mining the wind and taking it to France or Spain or Florida or someplace that's not out there. But the real opportunity is in the community wind space. The Midwest Interconnect Authority just did their 6-month study and they disapproved all projects over 5 megawatts because they can't fit on the grid. They just threw them all back. But at 5 megawatts, it's no problem. The thing about it is that we have to have a financing model that supports it. So if you want loan guarantees, for example, and you have a 2 or 3 megawatt project, you can't afford $75,000 application fee with the uncertainty of maybe not getting a loan guarantee. You need to be able to put these turbines out in small package, distribute them, and then put them near the communities. And this is even more the case when you move from South Dakota and Minnesota and Iowa into the more populated Midwest, into Indiana and Ohio, where there's still good wind, but you got to get it closer to the communities, and you got to give a chance for people to feel like it's their own. And so in addition to extending the cash grant, I'd like to suggest we also look at the passive versus active income aspect of this. There's a bill in front of Congress that will make it possible for individuals to invest and receive the same kind of benefits for wind and solar investment that they're getting for oil and gas, namely that it will be counted as an active income investment. So you can write off the depreciation and passive losses. You'll see an incredible wave of interest and investment in renewable energy if we can let ordinary Americans participate in repowering America.
She should tell us what she's doing. It's very interesting.
My company also uses financing on the tax credit side. U.S. Bank is our financing partner. We are a residential solar company. We're the leading residential solar company in the country. And what we do is we buy the system on behalf of the homeowner. So we install on their rooftop for free. Then we sign a long-term contract with the homeowner to either lease them the panels or actually sell them the electricity per kilowatt hour and save them money immediately. I agree with some of the comments that were made down there that what's holding us up, we have thousands of customers, we have people in our pipeline, is working capital issues. Working capital issues for the installers. So what happens when they submit a permit and it takes 9 months for them to get through the permitting department, the utility administration takes 6 months to administer the rebate? They have to slow down because they're not going to get paid, and we're not going to get paid by our tax credit from U.S. Bank until that project is signed off on. So we're moving very slowly. So a very simple recommendation would be, grant money to permitting departments, grant money to rebate administrators to just staff up those functions. Another piece of policy that would very much help would be bonus depreciation and extension of bonus depreciation. So what happens right now when we develop a project, because of the way the accounting works, there's phantom income and we own a ton of income tax in the first year. Extending bonus depreciation for another year would not cost the government anything more than, you know, 1 year time value of money, because we're gonna eventually, you know, pay back the income tax. It just solves a problem where, you know, where it's really expensive for corporations to borrow money right now, it's less expensive for the federal government to borrow money right now, and, you know, in that type of a market, bonus depreciation makes a ton of sense. And then, you know, the last comment I just wanted to make is regarding PACE, you know, because we very much endorse PACE and think it makes a lot of sense on the energy efficiency side. We do not think it makes a lot of sense for residential solar. We think that this, on the solar side, the problem's already being solved by the private market. It's being solved well by the private market. We can actually do it at a lower implied financing rate. And, you know, there are a lot of unintended consequences that I think may fall out of it, and would be happy to share those as well.
Thank you, Carol. Tom Soto, Creighton Equity Partners. Again, thank you for having us here, Secretary Chu, Ms. Browner, and our good friend, White House CEQ Chair Nancy Sutley, who's also here. I'm an investor. We invest in companies like those folks around the table, and so we get a very good high-altitude view about and able to determine what are the blocking, what are the obstacles toward getting to fruition to returns. And to us, what we've been able to determine really is, you know, there really is no credit out there. And project financing is probably the single greatest key. If you're asking how do we create jobs, the answer is to allow additional capital to be put and even restricted toward conservation infrastructure, clean tech, project finance. When Leah was talking about whether we could go out and convert or renovate community colleges and schools, those very same school superintendents are looking at their balance sheet and saying, how am I going to pay for this upfront cost? Unless they have some type of institutional debt approved by the bondholders or the voters, or they have some credit facility, most of which they don't have right now, is going to fall on the backs of the contractors, who, by the way, have an additional stumbling block, which is bonding capacity. Yep. And whether they are able to put up a $5 million bond for a $5 million project, which won't get reimbursed for at least a year after that project has been producing electricity and therefore is out of the woods in terms of being a viable long-term investment. Here's the other thing, is that there is a great unsung hero that unfortunately I don't see here. There are actually two unsung heroes for clean tech. The first is labor. I'm glad to see that we have labor participating in this, because it's taken years and years and years to cultivate that relationship. And now with things like Apollo Alliance and the role that labor has been playing, it has increased the velocity of making this a priority. The second unsung hero really is, before Wall Street got interested in wind, it really was the pensions across the country that sneezed and Wall Street caught a cold. And we have to begin to see what type of collaborative, and I would urge the Department of Energy to determine whether there's an opportunity for your agency in the White House to even convene a forum or a discussion amongst large state pensions that have mandates within their asset classes to invest in clean tech. Those are the people driving the train right now. My fund is small. I have $200 million to invest. About 100 has been committed. Have 7 or 8 companies that are doing extremely well given the atmosphere right now, from consumer products to a biofuels plant to a earth heat exchange company. These are companies that would not be where they're at. That's about $95 million actually out to work, about 200 employees as a result of that. And that would not happen without, first and foremost, CalPERS and CalSTRS putting out a mandate in 2004 saying we're going to invest in climate change responding technologies, because not only do we believe we're going to get good jobs and good environmental benefit, but superior returns. That has helped to start this movement to the point where we're at right now. Those are going to be the links to long-term job development. But we have to address how is it that we're going to create some type of project finance facility, because it's not going to be the 5 homes and the 10 homes. It's going to be the LA Community College District. It's going to be Chicago. It's going to be New York. And that doesn't mean going in there with a $30 million proposal and hoping that you could bond it. It means that there's going to be some type of support, of which, as an investor, based on those types of returns through the cost savings,
the Department of Energy or whomever participates would be able to get that, those returns necessary, but doing it on a mass scale that could create high income, middle income jobs. We have a company called EnLink Geoenergy, and we're doing San Francisco City College right now, but for a typical high school, that earth heat exchange technology will eliminate 70% of your heating and chilling costs for a typical high school, and over 20 years, 25 million pounds of carbon from going into the air. I, as an investor, am looking at it for the cost savings benefit, the build, own, operate as an asset, and possibly, if we could move the ball up the line, the cap and trade portion of it by holding on to the carbon credits.
Okay, so I have a bunch of hands up, people who haven't spoken, Leo, so hold on for just give me one second to make sure we hear from the folks we haven't heard from. I have Stephanie's hand was up, Jeff's hand was up, David's hand was up, Jan's hand was up.
Sounds like that 10 minutes.
So why don't we go, we'll start with Stephanie. We want to make sure everyone gets...
Yes, and I'll keep it short because there's some duplication and I won't comment on that. Just quickly back on renewables. We have invested $5 billion in the manufacture of polysilicon, which goes into solar cells. And through that investment, we are creating advanced manufacturing jobs in America. These jobs are going into Michigan, the state that drastically needs employment, and into Tennessee. For every 100 megawatts of solar invested, you're going to create about 3,000 jobs in that entire value chain. We need incentives that keep this manufacturing in America. Our product is immediately shipped offshore and converted into modules. And we need to bring those jobs back here for the marketplace here. And there are a few things that I think quickly could jumpstart this. The 48C is 3x oversubscribed, double the $2.3 billion in that. Companies need some certainty around their investments. That would help jumpstart this dramatically. Keep Treasury grants for renewables. There are companies who do not have the benefit of that a tax break will bring them. They need the grants. Our customers tell us they need the grants. They need access to capital, which has already been talked about, and they need to lower the bureaucratic burden when they're putting solar energy, either on residential or in big concentrated solar fields. The bureaucracy can take a year for some of these.
Thank you.
I want to take a slightly different tact, although I think we could all agree that some of the bureaucratic obstacles are serious. There are so many ideas out there, and with enough tax breaks, any idea will pass a test. I believe that there needs to be a little bit of systematic scrutiny of this more than I sense right now. First, do these specific technologies really pass a basic cost test? We're not testing that so much with this very haphazard approach we have right now. Second, what do they imply about cost per CO2 abated? The cash for clunkers, in my view, fails that test miserably. I think it doesn't even come close to a reasonable approach for this country to be smashing up well-functioning vehicles so that people buy new ones. To my mind, it's not the right approach. Ethanol, I don't believe, comes close to this also, not this first generation. It's a disaster, in my opinion, from the food market point of view, from the CO2 abated point of view. Second generation, if it comes, great.
We'll have to talk first generation offline because your data is wrong, sir. The data is wrong.
I'm a big fan of yours, but I'm not a big fan of first generation ethanol. I think it's costing us a fortune. So if we don't have some basic hurdles to pass, anything can pass muster with the right amount of subsidy, and I think we'll end up spending a fortune on this. Next point I wanted to make is a lot of this is about systems. And so a lot of things can't get done until the grid is right, until other land use measures are right. And so if we approach this in a very haphazard way, we'll never get the scale that we need. That's true of electric vehicles. It's true of carbon capture and sequestration. It's true if we're going to come back to nuclear and many other areas that are relevant for a low carbon economy. In terms of project financing, we have a proposal that I think is a very good one that's been was put on the table by the president, the National Infrastructure Bank, which would be a new way, responsibly, to put together complex public-private partnership financing. But it never really caught anybody's fancy in Congress, and I think it's a shortcoming for us in terms of really creating what we want here. The second from last point I want to make is we don't have a plan yet, though we're groping for one, and we now have a goal, 17% CO2 reduction by 2020. I believe if we had a national plan to achieve that, not simply a backroom negotiation in the Congress, but a national plan, the public would rally to it. And I feel that we're missing that right now, the quantification of how that can be accomplished. And the last point I'd like to make, again, not meaning to refute a lot of great ideas around the table or contradict them in any way, most of the things we need to do in this country for job creation, serious things we need to do, cannot really be done in 6 months or a year. And if we are relentlessly pursuing the most short-term strategies, we're never going to get to the long-term greatness that we expect of this country. And so I would hope we could push the horizon of our thinking to a 5 to 10 year horizon on all of these areas, because at a minimum we need that for every single technology around the table. And if Congress thinks it's all going to be solved in the next 12 months or shovel ready, all we'll do is get a lot of very insufficient projects, and we will not get the transformation which you both are leading so well and that the American people are expecting. And they'll wait. They will wait in the sense of saying if it's serious and it's going to transform the country and we're going to have a great industrial leadership and a new infrastructure base and a clean economy in 10 years, that's worth investing for and taking our time to do right.
You ought to come around. They're not waiting past November. Okay. They're pissed off. There's no job.
I know, but you know, we are in such a complex state in the globe and in the real phenomena that we're discussing around the table and in the technological transformation, they cannot be changed in 6 months.
Right now, we'll start putting people back.
Good things we should do.
I think we can agree on the need for both. David?
Thank you, Carolyn. Secretary, thank you. My name is David Lincoln. With Element Partners, and like Tom Soto, we are a longtime investor in renewables and clean tech, a fairly significant investor in the sector. And I'll try to be somewhat succinct, but I actually want to get back to the policy issues, which is what I think we're trying to achieve today. And actually, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that General Clark threw one out on the table, which is very critical, quite frankly, around a lot of issues, particularly around renewables today, which is the tax in lieu credit program. And just the timeline related to that is having a major impact on manufacturing turbine sales because, like all investors, we're looking at a very succinct timeline for achievement of that. And inventory is being consumed right now and liquidated, but new manufacturing, and in fact, OEM manufacturing of turbines is dropping off right now because they're looking into 2010 for that. So just as a policy consideration is an extension of the cash in lieu of credit program that's out there. But the point I want to make, and this goes back to Tom's point, quite frankly, goes back to the points both around efficiency and renewables, is the missing component right now is access to capital and structure. And Tom, I think Tom clearly pointed that out right now. And this is both for these community projects that you spoke around for efficiency. We do need scale, as we're now starting to see in some of the renewable programs, for efficiency as well. And one missing link in the capital structure that I think can be driven by policy right now is the utility, the utilities themselves, and quite frankly, access to the utility balance sheet that is out there. There are major players in this. They have the capital today, and we're going through policy debate. I believe it will take a long time to ever see an effectively implemented federal renewable energy standard, but there are 26 states that have standards in place right now. They're quite frankly a little more aggressive, and it looks like we're going to end up in the energy bill, hopefully when we see that. And they are somewhat effective, and they are driving utility behavior as long as they believe that they will be enforced long term. But they have access to capital both for efficiency and for renewables out there, and I think particularly around efficiency right now, just the language of what is included in efficiency needs to be changed and driven and expanded. And so, you know, fortunately, because of the way our nation is set up and the states enforce, you know, the utility standards presently, there needs to be some influence given to the utilities to perhaps expand efficiency. Wood pellets, actually, Frank and I were talking about earlier, wood pellets as a source of home heating are not included in any sort of efficiency standard, and yet they're a very, very significant part of a home heating base that could be utilized. Energy efficiency for insulation, for windows, all those things are tax credits, but they're not necessarily, depending on state, being part of the portfolio or efficiency standard for utilities. And so expanding language to allow them to meet their criteria will give them greater incentives and also potentially get them involved in these community programs, Secretary Chu, that you described. That's exactly what we need, but we need capital for those communities, not just tax credits to the consumers to make the investment in windows or efficiency, but some access to capital through utilities. And getting them involved, I think, is a very important aspect.
Can I ask the group a question? Because several of you have sort of touched on this, no one's spoken to it quite directly. How important is it to get in place sort of a national renewable electricity standard to get in place the cap on the carbon to? Is that what you were anxious to talk about?
Yes. It's massive.
It's massive.
Yeah.
It's
like critical.
Yeah, forget it.
Got to.
We have.
On every issue, certainty is important.
Jan, go ahead. You're going to say the same thing.
Jan, I worked in the. I got to raise your question.
I'm Jan Blitterskor, CEO of Energy Systems, and we're a manufacturer of wind measuring equipment for the wind energy industry. We've been in business for 27 years. So I've seen firsthand the evolution of wind energy over that period of time. And I just have to say that I am most concerned today than I've ever, ever been about the status of the wind industry. And it's all about that long-term vision and that commitment. What you said before about the start and stop nature of incentives has been hard on this industry all along.
Right.
It's critical now. If I had come here last year, I would have told you about this incredible momentum and incredible growth curve of what was happening as installed capacity. And it's just the momentum has
fallen
off.
And that's because there's just no long-term predictability.
Well, it's the economic recession, which should get terribly. It's that lack of access to capital. It's no long-term policy. It's no long-term commitment. So what we have in the U.S. manufacturing is a lack of confidence now of where we're going to go. And it's going to take a while to build that momentum back up. So absolutely, that long-term, whatever it is, has to be in place.
So, John, and then... Tom Friedman, can I put you on the spot? You've been very bullish on.
Let other people talk. I'll come in after.
So John.
I'll bridge Jeff and Leo here. I think that the reality is, and I think the focus of the administration indicates, that these green tech sustainable technologies are not niche short-term plays. They're the future of creating the long-term sustainable economy that we all want. And so the short term needs to be aligned, I think, with the long term. And I think Jeff's focus on the long term is, though, important because the kind of standardizing that, one of the problems, I think, in this space is the balkanization. We've already heard it around the table. The fact that there's so many entities, the role of the states is so strong, and you have a tremendous convening power, not just at the public private level, but amongst the states as well, to get national policy in place that I think, or at least shared state policy in place that could be a tremendous driver. The financing problem is not a green tech space problem. Geithner should be at this table too, because it's really a problem of getting credit to SMEs overall, and it's going to get worse, I think, before it gets better. The effect on regional banks from their exposure to commercial real estate is going to keep things, I think, very tight for a very long time. The real question in my mind is, are the solutions in that space, should they be aimed more generically at getting credit flowing to small and medium-sized enterprises, or can you use specific facilities to do what I think has been suggested around the table, either through, I mean, I'm all for using TARP money, maybe we can think up the mechanism for getting that through an SBD or something like that to regional banks and smaller banks to get that money out. But just a couple of other things, because I think you have the capacity to do them. The United States government is about to own an awful lot of real estate that it didn't own a year ago, and it's going to own a lot more a year from now. And I think applying what you want to do could be a tremendous job creator to do energy audits on repossessed housing, to multiply that effect, do that in large units, and then put those back into the service of particularly of low and moderate income housing. That's something I think you can do now, and we have the resources and the wherewithal to do. The other place, this is maybe my pet issue that I think that you ought to give some focus on in this arena, is the tremendous job losses amongst young people, and the tremendous numbers of unemployment amongst people in hard-to-serve communities in particular. And align myself with your earlier comments. I think for a relatively small amount of money, putting money into AmeriCorps, into youth build, into service opportunities for young people who are facing really lifelong problems in their careers and their income growth, because in the scale of things, it's a very small investment that could and apply to giving people the skills to be in business in these areas would be a big, you'd get a big bang for the buck. So I recommend that to your employee director.
We have to just, let's
I just want to say one very quick thing. So I've learned from all the people here, just in my own research, that the question of certainty, there is nothing more important than that. Give me three things. Give me a national RPS, like the European Union has. Mm-hmm. Give me key efficiency standards for houses and buildings. And give me a fixed, long-term, durable price on carbon. And then just get out of the way. I think the market will take care of 90% of the rest. Because one of the things I really worry about with the way we've got it constructed up to now and kind of running away from the price signal is that we got all these programs, but we have all these programs, but so many of them are designed to fit into one government thing or another. What you need to make this a revolution is consumer pull. And consumer pull starts with a fixed, long-term, durable price signal. And I really believe that Bob Lutz, he's not someone I've often quoted, but he did get it right when he said, the government's telling us now to make smaller, more fuel-efficient cars, but it refuses to have a gasoline tax. He said, well, that's like ordering every shirt maker in America to only make size smalls and never asking the American people to go on a diet. If you don't have the price signal that gives you consumer pull consistently, you're all going to be here in Washington every day lobbying for your program, and there will be nothing systematic. And without a system, you don't have a solution. You have a hobby.
I completely, to put a point on that, I'm Scott Lang, the CEO at Silver Spring Networks. We are the leading smart grid networking company in the United States and have got a lot of traction outside of the United States. And we sell to utility companies. That's our customer. And many utilities are moving very fast and many are moving very slowly. But of the 18 billion meters that you talked about, that we're doing probably 10 to 12,000 per day now of installation, there is not this price signal that we're going to give to the consumer that we have got to figure out. I think if we show pricing and put that in front of people, give them a chance to log onto a portal or an in-home device, which is also going to spur new creativity, new manufacturing, new devices that go in the home that people can buy. And I completely agree with Tom that the price on carbon is critical. The other thing is I have a senior in high school, and she's been on the college tours lately.
How's that going?
It's going great. She's gotten in one, and it's all set. But you know what was interesting? 70% of the colleges now have sustainability programs. I was blown away. And my daughter said, that's a key requirement for me. When our kids come out of school, having now consciously understanding the importance of sustainability, efficiency, cutting across all of these three things that you listed, we've got to have a mission in the 21st century to give them something that they can aspire to. And we can't treat our atmosphere like, that it's just a free garbage dump. and there should be a tax for it if utilities want to do that. Those training programs are going to go to their high school students. High schoolers, if they see that vision, are going to want to fight a little harder to go to college. And I think that's also something that the long-term nature of what Jeff talked about is very important.
The glue that binds us, Tom said it very well, those three, plus one more issue, Stephanie hit it. We're very exposed to global competition, right? So you cannot lose that. I mean, the blow has to come. We can leave, okay? This administration has to grab this topic, no question. It is the time. And I just really believe that what has to happen, with all due respect to all three of you who are leading this at the table, it has to be owned by the entire administration. We need a, this Jeff said before you came around, this integrated approach. We will create the short-term jobs if we have certainty, we have runways. And all the three things Tom said, violently agree with them. In fact, Dow's the last CEO to admit it, but I violently agree with them. Because advanced manufacturing in this country, R&D out of the universities and federally funded to initiate the catalyst to get us to co-invest, solar, you name it, renewables. We will invest with those three things, plus recognizing that some of the stuff that we do to hurt us, we're globally exposed. So we've got to find a way to integrate tax, trade, worker retraining, energy policy, and of course a price empowerment certainty.
Sure.
I don't know how you bring that together at the administration level. That is, I think, maybe the question you're being asked to answer. How do you bring that all together? Because that's big government. Mm-hmm.
The one thing that is really, when Janet spoke, it really rang my bell. Long-term strategic positioning creates short-term jobs. And I think about Gamesa. If I would have been here last year in August, I could have told you that we had 1,200 people at Gamesa. They thought they were sold out in 2012. Today, when I'm here, Gamesa's laid off last week. We're down to 200 and some employees, and I don't think they got enough orders to carry them through next summer. And that's because there's no certainty, there's no funding, and there's not a long-term strategy. I don't know if I'm on the same page as Tom, but I think what we need is a feed-in tariff, a renewable energy standard with a feed-in tariff, and then people know.
The 20-year tariff in Germany. Yeah, they
people
know for 20
people
years,
know
but you can't do
going.
It in the U.S.
The last thing I want to put on the table about this is I've listened to everybody and I've been restrained. That we cannot avoid the fact that everybody's talking about installing things that will reduce carbon and reduce energy consumption, but no one's talking about manufacturing those things in America.
Why will
we need
to
So we haven't heard.
Well, I'm Ron Saxton with Geldwin. We're the country's largest door and window company, and I want to keep coming back. A lot of these are swell ideas, but we, you know, efficient windows save energy right away. We make 100% of the windows installed in America. Mm-hmm. We create American manufacturing jobs, we create American installation jobs, and the sales jobs, and the trucking jobs, and everything else. Those workers are out of work, ready to go to work tomorrow. And all these things that create energy are wonderful. But we can save energy at incredibly efficient prices if we just get to work on it.
When you talked about how the sale of your replacement windows are up.
Well, you know, Home Depot is a huge, you know, where we sell a lot of these. You know, the stimulus, which was, you know, provision that relates to windows, has some problems with it. We've still sold over 250,000 windows under that, and other window companies selling similar things. There's a Senators Rockefeller and Grassley have an amendment to actually fix it so it'll be the right standard instead of the wrong standard, and we'll sell more windows. Those are great. We created jobs, we saved jobs, it's happening, it's part of what's working here. It could be dramatically bigger. You know, 40% or so, people use different numbers, but huge percent of the energy used in America is used in buildings. There are over 1 billion single-pane inefficient windows out there right now. All these other things are great. I hope we do all of them. But replacing single-pane windows is incredible for saving energy. And again, they're American jobs, American good, and we can do it right away. So I just want to come back. You know, it's great to have a long-term plan. It's great to be focused on all these things that have long-term. But I'm with you. We got people out of work right now who can get back to work right now if we're focusing on some of these things that can happen right now.
I want to weigh in here a little bit. I think this goes to the financing and the credit.
Mm-hmm.
If what we're doing in the Department of Energy is we're beginning to look at what's the lowest cost way of getting stimulating the economy, getting people back to work, and
there's dual reasons to mitigate its carbon, to restart high-tech manufacturing. And what I keep on going back to is low financing. If you do financing, we can overcome the inertia barrier, ignorance barrier. But for example, in retrofitting either commercial buildings or residential buildings, financing.
Commercial too, we sell commercial.
Absolutely. So if you overcome financing and get the big players to lock together to actually drive the cost down, this could be a big win. It could create immediate jobs. And I'm thinking that if you do it right, you know, the CEO, the Council of Economic Advisors, has put a price on each job we're creating, $92,000. I think financing, a little assistance in financing for low interest loans, can actually do
multiplies
much more than $92,000 per job, so that people can start borrowing money, maybe not 2%, but let's say at 5%.
Even at 5%, you could do
right. You can do a lot in commercial. I've toured factories where you know they're. These are all factories, they don't have the money to do anything, and they know they're just throwing money away.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And if we can do the financing, and maybe the federal, and we do need Geithner here.
You can buy down.
You can buy down a lot of that stuff, yeah. And so out-of-pocket expenses in the private sector would, and you get the jobs immediately. And a lot of those doors and windows and things and insulation material are in the United States.
Steve, can I just say, can I just say one thing?
Yes.
I'll keep it very short, which is, because someone alluded to this, you guys are in my view, the absolute A-team of energy and environment. But
you better make it quick.
I'll save it for later.
You got a chair for me here?
Yep, you got
the other one up.
Right at the top.
Oh, see there? I like that. Please, everybody have a seat. And I'll make sure to say hello to everybody before you head down. I'm sure that this has been a lively conversation. I saw you as I was walking in, you guys were beating up on Chu. Let me just say this. We are completely sold that if we are to shift from the bubble and bust model that we've had and start investing in things that can be a long-term engine of economic growth, that clean energy is our best candidate for that. So we want to make a big push in this area. Now, we have some tensions. Tension number one is we don't yet have a price on carbon. Which means that a lot of people are on the sidelines waiting. And so if you guys all have 60 votes in the Senate, please let me know. But this is not a legislative strategy meeting, but we have to be honest that until we get some certainty on that, it's harder than we'd like it to be to leverage private dollars in. Number two is, as everybody I think is aware, we've just got fiscal constraints that are tough. So whatever we do has to be strategic and surgical. We don't have the ability to just spend hundreds of billions of dollars, at least in the short term, on this. Number three, the constraint we have is that a lot of the clean energy ideas that we floated around have just long time horizons, and there's a sense of urgency now about getting job growth. So my hope is what you guys have been discussing is how within those parameters, we can get something out that is relatively quick and visible, but is a good investment in the long-term needs of the future and actually helps to shape the political environment, the political debate, so that we can start getting that certainty in corporate America that will lead to strong investment on the clean energy side. So that's all that I've got to say. We're running a little bit late, so we had, I think, about 10 minutes in here. I'm making an executive decision that we can extend it to 15 or so before we go down to talk.
Well, we've heard some people have shared, I think, some good ideas and some we've got a lot of good information here. I think, Mr. President, you make the one point that's been made over and over again, which is we need the certainty, we need the predictability, we need the standards in place, whether it's a renewable standard, whether it's building efficiency standards, whether it's a price on carbon, we need those. The second issue that virtually everyone has mentioned is the financing challenge, is that there's just a lot of capital constraints right now, and so it's very, very hard. And then the third issue has been sort of the boom and bust cycle, and particularly we heard from General Clark and others about the challenges in the wind energy. We've also heard about the job opportunities, and Stephanie, maybe you could just share one of the statistics that you gave about, or maybe explain to the President what your company does and then what you see in terms of the manufacturing opportunities.
Well, you know, I think,
good to see you.
Thank you very much. We feel so strongly that America can take back advanced manufacturing jobs and create more advanced manufacturing jobs, and I think the mechanism to do that is in renewable energies and in the innovation that comes with renewables, with batteries, with everything that comes around that. If we invest for every 100 megawatts of solar that we put in the ground, we're creating 3,000 jobs. And these are jobs that we can retrain people for, installation jobs, good high-tech jobs that need to be in America. And I get so frustrated when the component that makes these solar cells work, that we manufacture, immediately, that we make here, immediately goes offshore to be converted into modules. And then it comes back in as an import.
Right.
And we need to make that conversion happen here.
Ron, right. Could you talk about your window experience?
Right, I'm Ron Saxton with Geldwin. We're a big window indoor company.
Right.
They're saying the country has, there are over a billion single-pane windows still in buildings right here. Just replacing those, you'd have huge energy savings, you reduce the greenhouse gas issues associated with the energy, but you create American jobs. All the windows in America are made in America. They're too heavy to ship them, too fragile. And so we make them here, American manufacturing jobs, American installation jobs for construction industry, jobs in every community, every place there's a building. So you get the jobs, you get the energy savings, you get the environmental benefits. The workers are ready to go. We don't need to build factories or anything. The factories are there. We used to build over 2 million new houses in America. This year we're building about 400,000, plenty of manufacturing infrastructure there. And so some of the places you do that are places like schools and government buildings and such, and some of those programs are going, but there could be a lot more of them going. A lot of them are houses. Some of them, poor, low-income housing, some regular housing. The kind of incentives needed vary from place to place. But most of the cost of it is paid from energy savings. And so we don't need government paying most of the cost. We just need government helping get some
the
of these programs
end.
Rolling.
Right.
Pull together the information, help do some of the education, do the things that let people see it. But for all, they're wonderful ideas about new technologies. Putting in efficient windows and doors and just stopping the energy from flowing out of your place is very cost effective in most instances. We only do it in the places. And it creates those jobs immediately. And so we're very enthusiastic about the prospect of putting those workers back to work and at the same time contributing to the energy goals and greenhouse gas goals that you talked about.
Well, I will say, not to tip our hand too much, but one of the things I would be surprised if we don't end up moving forward on is an aggressive agenda for energy efficiency and weatherization, because that is an area where you can get it up and running relatively quickly. You don't need new technologies.
Right.
It is, it really brings home a lot of the advanced manufacturing that's got to be done here. And it pays for itself.
Yes.
The challenge here is actually getting consumers the right incentives, but then also packaging the consumer finding the right contractor, the right materials, a certification program, right? I mean, so there are a lot of things that we've been exploring, and Carol's been working with Stephen and others to lead on.
We had a couple folks here who have talked about that whole thing about consumer right. inertia, maybe Andrew and Frank.
Mr. President, Andrew Lewis of Dow Chemical, we actually are right in that channel. We sell insulation products, roofing products, moisture barriers, air seal barriers, all those. We touch a lot of these points, all the way to the windows, the roofs, the whole thing. We think there's a framework here where we can aggregate to the professional reinstaller and do the audits to help the consumer. So the professional installer is sitting there as a worker who can be retrained,
mm-hmm.
can be in fact put in business if the financing thing, mm-hmm. That financing point is huge. But to put a systems integrator in the channel You actually have a few companies, and we volunteer to help do this. We can actually help the integration. I've got the whole touch points here. I've got the channels designed. We showed them to Carol last week, I think it was, Secretary Chu. This is a program that the federal government says this is important to do. The power of your statement, okay, I think it can be launched very quickly if we can get help on the financing side. That's
good. I would just say, Mr. President, Frank Blake from the Home Depot, so we sell a lot of Joe Wynn.
We make them and they sell them.
Frank, we're very interested in you helping on the marketing side of this.
Well, 30% of our business is small professional contractors. These are folks who employ less than 5 people, less than $500,000 revenue. And they've been disproportionately hit in the downturn, a big opportunity, I think, to turn that around. The energy tax credit has helped some, but I think it could be broader. And the one thing I'd say is simplicity is very important. Getting something that everybody can understand and rally around. Right.
Well, okay. I mean, just very specifically, all of us, I think, were a little surprised by what happened with cash with clunkers. We're trying to figure out, man, how did that thing just blow up the way it did? And you know, it seems obvious in retrospect, but I'm not sure everybody thought about it early. Essentially, all the auto companies did the marketing. They did the advertising in a way that the government just can't do, and frankly, even if we did it, people wouldn't listen. And so the collaboration with contractors, Home Depot, you know, folks who are out there and people think are credible on this issue, I think, is absolutely critical.
Mr. President, in addition to just what was said about the windows, which I totally support because a lot of our folks help make the glass, is retrofitting public buildings, and in particular schools, because we can retrofit the windows, we can retrofit the air handling systems, we can retrofit the heating and cooling, we can retrofit the lighting, and if we do that with an element of domestic content, unemployment in the construction is 25%. People are skilled, ready to go to work. Our plants are down, steel's not going into it, windows not going into it, so I think the federal government leading on infrastructure modernization in public buildings will help create business partnerships in the private sector to start retrofitting private buildings as well. So
Terry's been trying to get
Mr. President, thank you. Carol, Secretary Chu. Like Leo, Mr. President, as you know, come from an industry that has 17% unemployment, 1.6 million construction workers out of work. Thanks to you and to the Recovery Act, that unemployment is down from 22%. So we are putting people back to work again. And we certainly support, whether it be commercial retrofit, renewables, but we've been focusing a lot of time and attention when it comes to residential weatherization. And because of your vision and the $5 billion through Secretary Chu's office to weatherize 1 million homes, as we talk about financing, as we talk about the opportunity, I mean, there's 100 million homes or thereabouts that we could retrofit. I think we also have to look at, we've talked about capacity, and we have to focus on workers and contractors. There's some great contractors that are here, but we are trying to go from 140,000 houses that we've weatherized a year to 1 million, and we're having challenges with that. Again, vision is how do we go to 50 million? And what we need to do is make sure our organization trains over 100,000 workers a year, as other organizations do, on construction and environmental skills training. I think we need to focus time and attention on the investment side, using pension funds, whether it be public or private, such as laborers and steel workers and others. But I think we also need to look at how do we build this to scale. And we do believe that you need independent auditors when you're going to do residential weatherization. Going in and coming out, because I think we have one shot at this as an administration, one shot as a country, and the great contractors that are here in this room and at this forum, but there's a lot that don't do it the way that it should. We have workers that need to be retrained. We have workers that are out of work who've been unemployed for 6 months or a year. I think we need to make sure that there's an accreditation process for contractors so that we're getting great contractors that know how to do the work. I think we need a certification process for workers that are going to become residential weatherization workers or work in commercial retrofit as a stepping stone towards a career. I'll just give you an example of what we've encountered, is that 250 workers trained in one part of the country, and 21 of 250 worked more than 3 months. part of that is because of the contracting mechanism as well. That wasn't the federal government's role. But how do we package this so that these are longer term jobs? And so that people can say, I'm going to go through training, I'm going to improve and upgrade my skills for a new industry, an emerging industry, that hopefully I can make a career out of, I think is critically important, that we build the accountability into the system so that we have quality assurance, whether it be a homeowner, whether it be a commercial building owner, whether it be investors, and have a trained and skilled workforce that says this is a step. This is a step towards my future as a worker in green construction.
We have not heard from the mayor, Mr. President, so maybe we can hear a few words.
Just briefly, Julian Castro.
I thought he was on our staff.
I think I'm the youngest one here.
I thought he was an intern. This guy's a mayor?
San Antonio, Texas.
I'm messing with you. I know who you are. Go ahead.
San Antonio has the largest publicly owned utility in the nation, about CPS Energy. And we're at the very beginning of spending $200 million to weatherize 60,000 homes in urban San Antonio, the core of San Antonio. But we received some stimulus money for weatherization. I think $6,500 per home is being spent on weatherization. Under our program, it's $3,200. And so there's a difference there in standards. And I absolutely agree that the certification of contractors and the training of workers to be able to do this in short order is a real issue for us. To the extent that resources can be invested there, you have something that is ready to go in different communities. And I think particularly where you have municipal entities, munis, you have something that they have their finger on the trigger of job creation.
Right.
And then just very briefly, secondly, it was mentioned a few moments ago, and I very much agree that to the extent that we're trying to change the culture of energy usage for the future, smart investments in curriculum and training in primary and secondary education, I think, make a lot of sense for the future.
Around energy.
Yeah.
You know, what we're finding is that we've been doing these programs across the country. And in Portland, for example, 500 homes creates 15 jobs for 1 year instead of creating a spike at one time. And so as we think about replicating the programs across the country and really first making it one clear program, the thing that's so attractive about Cash for Clunkers is it is that the auto industry then said, we're going to sell this program. And so to me, the question for us as a group and is how do we do a good job of, as there are programs that are being replicated and scaled, of marketing it not as a program of the federal government, but as a cost savings economic program. Because I think, you know, from having the experience as someone who just watched the climate debate, the failure for me in my mind is I try to think about how to talk about the climate to my grandmother, and what my grandmother wants to know is about Cash for Clunkers. She wants to know, how do you save money? And I think if we could even begin to just talk about this in terms of what we're trying to figure out as a group is how to create American jobs, how to decrease unemployment, how to make sure that people's utility bills get cheaper. That's really, I think, our task. Because then you say, look, I'm in Portland, you know, I'm an environmentalist, but most importantly, I'm someone who had a middle-class mom who's a single mom, and I want to try to figure out how people like that have jobs. And so I think that's, I think, our challenge is to talk about that.
You know, Mr. President, the cheapest Cash for Clunkers program you could implement, I think, is if you announce tomorrow that you are ordering the Secret Service to give you a Ford Explorer hybrid car, and that every car in your motorcade would be an American-made hybrid car. The example you would set, I would not underestimate that.
No, we have actually talked about it. The car I have is a little heavy.
Yeah, I know.
As good as hybrid technology has become, it would not go faster than 15 miles per hour. So that's very obvious. It's a spec, so much. Go ahead. We're kind of running out of time. We focused a lot on energy efficiency. I think that's something, as I said, that can have an immediate, rapid impact. The most important thing here that we've talked about is packaging and marketing. I mean, I think all of us understand what it could accomplish in relatively short order. And so we may be asking some of the participants here to help us think through how that gets done in a way that jumpstarts what could be, as you said, Terry, I think a multi-year investment. I don't want to lose the fact that on renewable energies, there is enormous potential as well. As I said before, our biggest challenge there is going to be getting carbon priced properly. And so I would just suggest to all of you that there is going to be an energy debate in the Senate, and a diverse group that is willing to go to bat, particularly those who are willing to go to bat who are not the usual suspects. Business, industry, just making some very strong stances on this issue so that the American people understand this is not a jobs killer but a jobs grower is going to be absolutely critical over the next several months. And I just want to plant that flag now so that when we come calling, and you guys who are members of the chamber or business roundtable or others, we're going to need you there. Otherwise, you're just we'll get sporadic progress here. But the unit costs on a lot of these renewable energies, if you're not factoring carbon in, you are not going to be able to catch up to coal.
Yep.
You just can't. Coal is going to be substantially cheaper for the duration,
yep,
unless people are taking into account the externalities that industry produces. So. Carol, anything else?
Yeah, it was a great conversation, and as the President said, we will no doubt be back to you all as we try and put together some ideas, and thank you so much.
Good. Thank you, everybody. Let's go downstairs. We'll spend an hour hearing from what other folks did and answer questions.